Isaiah chapter 11. A shoot shall come out from the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. His delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt around his waist, and faithfulness the belt around his loins. The wolf shall live with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put its hand on the adder's den. They will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. On that day, the root of Jesse shall stand as a signal to the peoples. The nations shall inquire of him, and his dwelling shall be glorious. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Now from Matthew's gospel, we switch to hearing about that odd creature, John the Baptist. In those days, John the Baptist appeared in the wilderness of Judea, proclaiming, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near." This is the one of whom the prophet Isaiah spoke when he said, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight." Now John wore clothing of camel's hair with a leather belt around his waist, and his food was locust and wild honey. Then the people of Israel and all Judea were going out to him and all the region along the Jordan, and they were baptized by him in the river Jordan, confessing their sins. This, too, is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
I find it interesting, and I hope you do too, that there are 34 verses in the Bible that mention belts, including the two passages that you just heard. Now, why is that? Of all the images in the good book, talking about belts seems so banal and kind of silly. So I did a little research into the clothing worn in the time of Jesus. Belts back then were bands of cloth, cord, or leather, like we heard John the Baptist's belt was made of leather, tied around the waist, and they could be loosened or tightened, I guess, depending on how much you'd eaten. There were, of course, no belt buckles back then, so I suppose it was important for wearers to know how to tie a good knot. There were two purposes for these belts. Using them prevented the flowing robes that people wore and that reached down all the way to their toes from interfering with their movement. And the biblical expression that we've all heard, to gird up one's loins, meant to put on a belt, which allowed people to walk and work easily so that they wouldn't trip. The expression signifies that the tightly belted person was ready for service. It is equivalent to our modern day expression of rolling up your sleeves. But belts also had another use. Bags, purses, or weapon holders could be attached to belts. You see, people back then didn't have pockets in their robes or their tunics. So it seems that belts back then were actually more functional than they are today. Belts today are more of an accessory than anything else, and an uncomfortable one at that. But beyond their functionality was their symbolism. Belts were worn at the center of one's body and pressed tightly into it. That centrality and closeness made belts take on an importance as an image. I think that's at least part of the reason why we find so many references to belts in the Old and New Testaments. For example, the Apostle Paul famously wrote to the people in Ephesus, "Fasten the belt of truth around your waist." In other words, make it so close and tight that you cannot forget how to be truthful. And when Isaiah describes the vision of the peaceable kingdom and its messianic king, he says in verse 5, "Righteousness shall be the belt around his waist, and faithfulness the belt around his loins." Before this, in the earlier chapters by the prophet Isaiah, there are doom and gloom reports of wars, corruption, and the social injustice that filled the land around 700 BC. The nation and society were in turmoil. Disillusionment and despair ran deep. Isaiah lamented the conditions, even as he cast judgments on the unfaithfulness of the Israelites. But he makes a sharp turn starting in chapter 11 when he describes the kind of leader who is to come to rescue that situation. He says, "The Spirit of the Lord shall rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord." What a hopeful vision Isaiah delivers for his hearers. He waxes poetically, describing how the king, who wears righteousness as the belt around his waist and faithfulness as the belt around his loins, will protect the poor. And we know that throughout the ancient Near East, the mark of a truly good king is his willingness to especially look out for widows and orphans. Of course, Isaiah was hoping for an earthly king who would bring deliverance. Or maybe he was waiting for the promised Messiah. With such a vision of the ruler to come, Isaiah goes on to describe quite poetically what life will look like in that newborn kingdom. There will be no hurt or destruction. Peace will abound between all animals and people. All will be safe and thrive. A 19th century painter, Edward Hicks, painted several of these benign coexisting paintings of animals, both domesticated and wild, living together in peace. This one's in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And around the edge of the painting are those words from Isaiah. His vision, the painter's vision, like that of Isaiah, is a world of peace, love, and tranquility. Way back in 1812, Hicks' Quaker congregation recorded him as a minister, and by 1813, he began traveling around Philadelphia as a preacher. His image is an image of a return to Eden when God's reign is finally consummated, when the anointed one mentioned is breaking in, completing the harmonious creation God intended from the very beginning. The earth will be filled with the knowledge of God. We, though, Christians, read these words from Isaiah differently from our own perspective, seeing that his vision was one of Jesus Christ himself. Christ is the perfect model of one who wore righteousness as the belt around his waist. And it's important to understand that Christians today see how Isaiah was describing not only the birth of Jesus, but also his second coming, like we talked about last week. Only when Christ comes again will this pastoral, Eden-like utopia come to pass. We await in Advent both the first and the second coming of Christ. That's when, after the second coming, this vision of paradise will be completely fulfilled. But let's think now more deeply about that belt of righteousness that Isaiah's king will wear. Righteousness. That's a word we don't hear or say too often. To be righteous does not mean that one is right and never wrong. Think of righteousness to mean being in right relationships. Relationships that are not dominating, controlling, or overly powerful. A right relationship is one in which God's image is seen and valued in each and every person. There is no exploitation or condescension in right relations. No one feels inferior or second class. No one feels superior or holier than thou. Right relationships are about caring for and building up each person. All are held equal and equally revered. It's difficult for us to imagine such a peaceable kingdom filled with such righteousness. Isaiah sets forth a holy agenda that is impossible to fathom, where equality will be enacted for the meek, where the wolf and the lamb will lie down together, and all creatures will see God's presence everywhere, in which the headlines of our age and every age before us will be replaced with stories of the oppressed receiving justice, violence not only ending, but reconciliation and lasting peace coming. It's a challenge for us to hear a glorious, hopeful text like this one and accept that the words are more than lovely poetry to comfort our weary souls. Our day and age is ripe with cynicism and skepticism, and reading about divine wisdom and understanding, reading about delight and faithfulness seems quaint, even maybe indulgent. The temptation is to brush the vision off and to face the fact that life is just never going to be like that. Work lives are busy making strategic plans, data analysis, preparing budgets, and setting achievable goals. Terms like cost-benefit risk management and return on investment consume time and energy, and in doing so, they limit our imagination. And you know, imagination might be another word for faithfulness. For as Paul wrote, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And that's what imagination is. Being faithful means welcoming the promises of God, however wonderful and mind-boggling they are. This year, I read a novel by Colum McCann entitled A Paragon. I recommend it to you. It's the true story of two fathers, one Palestinian and one Israeli, who have both lost their daughters to the violence that surrounds them. We learn how a suicide belt, not a belt of righteousness, detonates, and how shrapnel flies, and how a rubber bullet compresses upon impact, and how it can fragment a skull. The author shares the lives of these two grieving fathers, the lives of their young daughters, The experience of crossing police checkpoints and surviving jail, the making of bullets, and the long, long, long conflicted history of that region. The unlikely friendship of the two fathers vibrates with empathy, presenting a portrayal of the complex conflict at the heart of the Holy Land. Like Isaiah's book, A Paragon begins with doom and gloom for Israeli-Palestinian relationships. And then again, like Isaiah in chapter 11, the book shifts dramatically. We learn that these two wounded fathers now travel the world together, retelling their story to audiences every day. They are urgently trying to find a peaceful solution to all of the underlying problems of their world, as daunting as they are. One of the fathers said, "Once I thought we could never solve our conflict and we would continue hating each one forever. But it's not written anywhere that we have to go on killing each other. When they killed my daughter, they killed my fear. I have no fear. I can do anything now." And this true novel does far more than make an argument for peace. As the other father put it, "I stumbled upon the most important question of all. What can you do personally in order to try to help prevent unbearable pain for others?" These men have answered that question in their quest for peace. But that powerful question, "What can you do personally in order to prevent unbearable pain for others?" comes to us. If we are faithful, we will be able to imagine, like Isaiah, a better world, free from sorrow, sighing, and pain, filled with peace and righteousness. It's an audacious possibility. The Savior we wait and prepare for is about miracles, not data. He's about relationships, not transactions. His ministry isn't about efficiency and getting a big bang for the buck. He leaves the 99 sheep and goes after the one in order to find it. He takes time to welcome little children. He makes enemies of the most powerful and corrupt. He eats with tax collectors, touches those deemed untouchable, and allows society's outcast to touch him. He spends most of the time with people incapable of connecting him to a network of wealthy supporters or patrons. This belt of righteousness that he wears upholds justice for the poor and extends care for the weak. It defies our earthly inclinations to hate or to fear the other. And it all gets started emerging as a tiny tendril from the stump of a tree. The stumps in our own lives where we feel cut off and maybe even dead can bring forth new life. Can we imagine that even now God might be nurturing the growth of something new and good in us and in our world? In and for this congregation, are we open to such newness and hopefulness? This Advent, we are invited to wrap ourselves with God's belt of righteousness and gird our loins with faithfulness to engage in the holy possibilities of doing something new and doing something good, preventing pain and making peace. May it be so for you and for me.